Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. This is Ken Hensley sitting in for Patrick Madrid as he's off for a few days, taking a little vacation. He's doing fine, so don't worry about him. The number here is 888-914-9149. Before the break, I was beginning to talk about the subject of evangelism, and in particular evangelism with those who doubt the existence of God or outright deny the existence of God. And I was talking about how my interest in apologetics of this nature even goes back a long way. Again, when I was in middle school, when I was in junior high school, I wound up with a copy of C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters in my hands, and I read it. And I remember thinking, on the one hand, I don't know what this guy's talking about on a lot of these things. And on the other hand, this guy's very bright. And I was attracted to it. I was interested. And so when I came back to the Lord about 10 years later, because I was 22 years old, when I came back as an adult to faith in the Lord Jesus. And before that, I remember I had a friend who was an atheist, and we were sitting in my backyard, and we were digging a hole. I guess we were planting something. And he looked at me at one point, and he just kind of said, "That's all we are." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Dirt. That's all we are." And I think the seed that had been planted in me when I was younger was still there. It hadn't gone away. Even though I'd forgotten about God, I'd forgotten about Christ, I had become a musician. That was really my life, and hanging with my friends and being a musician. But I looked up at him and I just responded, "No. We're not just dirt. I know this." I'm not saying I said that part. All I said was no. But I kind of knew. And so when I began to attend a home Bible study at the age of 22, and when I came back, or my faith in Christ was revived and came alive again, I had an immediate interest in apologetics, because none of my friends were Christians. Now, you know, the crowd I hang out with, that I hung out with, was purely secular, and so right away I was interested in knowing how I could defend the truth of what I'd come to believe. And so, you know, I read C.S. Lewis in depth at that point. I read other books. I remember Josh McDowell's famous book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Another one by John Warwick Montgomery, History and Christianity. And there were a number. But my interest in apologetics goes back then for more than 40 years in my life. And so I've thought a lot about this. And I want to talk today about how I approach the subject of doing evangelism with those who doubt the existence of God, those who deny the existence of God. And I'm hoping this will be helpful. If you have questions about this, you can call in. The number here is 888-914-9149. If you have questions about the Holy Land, I mentioned I'm going to be leading a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. In fact, I fly out this Friday. So if you have questions about that, questions about anything. I know we have a couple of people on the line right now. I'm just going to ask you to wait a little bit longer because I want to go into this a bit more. Okay, here's where I start. And this is really how I start when I think about doing evangelism with anyone, but especially with agnostics and atheists. When I speak to someone who's struggling with the existence of God, I want to remind myself of who it is I'm dealing with. First, I want to remind myself, and I want to keep it clearly in mind, I'm speaking to someone created by God, someone who is the image and likeness of God, someone God is drawing to himself, someone who I believe will never find the truth and happiness he, she is seeking, except in God. And I'm thinking of paragraph 27 from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, where we read, the desire for God is written in the human heart, because man is created by God and for God, and God never ceases to draw man to himself. Only in God will he find the truth and happiness he never stops searching for. Now, I understand this is not what the atheist thinks of himself. You know, the more consistently atheistic someone is, you know, he may believe, well, if he's an atheist, he will believe. He may believe that he is nothing more than a very complicated animal. He is the natural product of a natural universe. He is the purely material product of a wholly material universe. So he looks at himself and he says, no, I'm just the product of random genetic mutations sorted out by natural selection over the course of millions of years. But that's not what I think of him or her. When I talk to someone who doesn't believe in God or is struggling with the thing, I want to keep in my mind who I believe this person is as a Catholic. And what I believe is this is a person created by God in the image and likeness of God, someone whom God is drawing to himself, and someone who will never find truth and happiness that he never stopped searching for except in God. Now, the great 17th century Catholic philosopher and mathematician Blaise Pascal said the same thing that the Catechism says, but in a little bit more detail, and I want to read it. Pascal said, all men seek happiness. This is without exception. Whatever different means they employ, they all tend to this end. This is the motive of every action of every man, even of those who hang themselves. He's saying, even the person who becomes so desperately sad and depressed that he hangs himself is still searching for happiness. He's just thinking there's no possibility of happiness here, maybe something better on the other side, or maybe nothing which would be better. So even the man who hangs himself is searching for happiness in a way. Pascal goes on, and yet after such a great number of years, no one without faith in God, he's saying, no one without God has reached the point to which all continually look. All complain, princes and subjects, noblemen and commoners, old and young, strong and weak, learned and ignorant, healthy and sick, of all countries, all times, all ages, and all conditions. A trial so long, so continuous, so uniform, should certainly convince us of our inability to reach the good by our own efforts, but example teaches us little. What is this, then, that this desire for happiness and this inability to find it, what is it that this proclaims to us, but that there was once in man a true happiness, of which there now remained to him only the mark and empty trace? He's making an allusion to the time before the fall, the Garden of Eden. There was once in man a true happiness, of which there now remained to him only the mark and empty trace, which he in vain tries to fill from all his surroundings, seeking in things absent the things he doesn't have, what he does not find in the things present, that is, the things he does have. Grass is always greener. I thought that money would make me happy, but it doesn't really do it. Maybe this other thing will. Pascal concludes, but these are all inadequate because the infinite abyss inside of us can only be filled by an infinite and immutable object, that is to say, by God himself. Now, this is something I know about the person I'm speaking with when I speak to someone who's struggling with the existence of God. Okay, the second thing I want to know, or the second thing that I do know about this person and that I want to keep in my mind is this. I know that this person I'm speaking to lives in a world that cries out the existence of the God who made it. This is taught clearly in Scripture. I think immediately of Psalm 19, verses 1 through 3, where we read, the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. That is the heavens declaring the glory of God. Their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the world. This is why the vast majority of people from the beginning of time have believed in God. I mean, obviously, just look at these stats, really. It's much more natural for human beings to look out at a beautiful sunset or to look at the stars, to look at this glorious creation, this amazing universe, and think immediately, God made this, or to believe in God. It's always been a very small minority that have really looked at the universe and said, no, it's just a giant accident. There is no God. I also think of Romans chapter 1, verse 20 here, where St. Paul writes, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they," that is men, women, everyone, "they are without excuse," Paul says. This God's eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen from the creation of the world through the things that have been made. So the person that I'm speaking to, I'm sitting at a table with a cup of coffee or with a beer, the person I'm speaking to, I believe, lives in a world that cries out the existence of the one who created it. In fact, I believe that my agnostic, my atheist friend is himself the most eloquent argument that exists for God's existence. The most eloquent argument. Why? Because he is the image and likeness of God. He has been created to be a mirror of God's being, God's nature. As a personal being, he reflects the personal nature of God. As a moral being, he reflects the moral nature of God. As a rational being, as a being with free will, as a creative being, as a being who loves, who desires, a being who cannot find happiness in this created world, cannot find the deep happiness that he's really looking for, a being who perceives meaning in things. In all of these ways, I know that my agnostic friend, my atheist friend, reflects the very being and nature of God. It turns out then, that while the atheist denies God's existence, at the very moment that he denies God's existence, he is the single most eloquent and convincing argument for God's existence. I like to say he's a walking, talking advertisement for God's existence. And then third, okay, so I sit across the table and I want to keep in my mind, I'm looking at someone here, I'm talking with someone here who has been created by God in the image of God, who seeks God, whether he knows it or not, someone who God is drawing to himself, someone who will never find the truth and happiness that he's searching for except in God, someone who lives in a universe that cries out the existence of God, and who is himself the most eloquent argument of all. I believe John Calvin, at the beginning of his Institutes of the Christian Religion, was talking about this, and he said that man cannot even look into a mirror without thinking of God, because as soon as he sees himself, he sees God, meaning that he is the image and likeness of God. Okay, point three here is this. It follows from this that a man, a woman who denies the existence of God is going to be a man, a woman who lives in tension. What do I mean by that? What I mean is this. This is a person who lives in tension, in a tension, constant tension, between what he or she says about the nature of the world in which we live. That there is no God. The universe is comprised of nothing but particles interacting with one another according to strict physical laws, chemistry. There's a tension that he's living in between what he says about the nature of the world and who he is as the image and likeness of God, living in a world that God created. And when I think about evangelism, and I'm going to begin to illustrate this in our next segment together, but when I think about evangelism with those who struggle with God's existence or who outright deny it, what I think about doing is attempting to kindly, gently, lovingly place my finger on that tension that I've just described. And there are a number of ways in which I approach this and want to do this, but that's what I want to do, is I want to place my finger on this tension that I believe exists within this person's life. The tension between what he or she says about the nature of this world and about the nature of him herself, and what he She knows in her heart of hearts, his heart of hearts, because of being God's creation and the very image and likeness of God, living in a world that God created. There's a line from a song by a Canadian singer-songwriter named Bruce Coburn. There's a line in the song where he says, the words are, it says, haunting hands of memory pluck silver strands of soul. Haunting hands of memory pluck silver strands of soul. And that, in a nutshell, is my evangelistic approach. That's what I'm after when I think of evangelism. I want to, as it were, remind the person I'm talking to of things that I believe he, she really knows in his heart of hearts, her heart of hearts. Things that cannot be escaped, really, by those who are the image and likeness of God, sitting there and yet denying that God exists at all. As one person has said, it's like two children playing in their backyard on a swing set. They can smell lunch being cooked inside. Mom's in the kitchen. They can smell, you know, the hot dogs or hamburgers being cooked. They can hear the sound of Dad mowing the front lawn, walking back and forth with his lawnmower. And they're sitting on their swing set, and they're discussing whether or not a mom or a dad may possibly exist. This is the tension that I'm talking about. And we're going to come back to this after we take a short break. I've got a couple of people on the phone as well. And so why don't we take a short break right now? The number here is 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. You can run off and quickly eat a taco, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes on The Patrick Madrid Show.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. This hour is sponsored by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union, where you can boost your savings with their 14-month share certificate, earning a 4.14% annual percentage yield. Info at relevantradio.com/certificate.
Real life solutions you can believe in. This is The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Oh, I love that music, Cyrus. You know, this is the kind of music that I can hear live if I go to certain restaurants right where I live here in Southern California. Very nice, very nice. Okay, 888-914-9149 is the phone number if you want to be on the Patrick Madrid Show. This is Ken Hensley sitting in for Patrick. And I want to apologize to a couple of callers who had called in. They had comments they wanted to make about the subject of marriage again, and they've dropped off the line. Anyway, thanks for calling in. Sorry I didn't get to you. I'm talking about evangelism with those who doubt or deny the existence of God. And I'm going to begin very, very soon here to put some meat on these bones, that is to flesh out a bit of what I'm talking about here. When I speak of the atheist living in tension between what he says is true of the world in which we live and who he is as the image and likeness of God. But let me give another analogy or illustration of what I mean by tension. Imagine someone who denies the existence of gravity or anything like gravity, okay? Denies the existence of gravity. Imagine he writes books about the non-existence of gravity. Imagine he's become quite famous and he tours the country giving lectures on the non-existence of gravity. And yet, when he walks out onto the stage, every time his foot hits the floor, he's contradicting his thesis. And the very fact that he doesn't glue his notes to the podium, the very fact that he doesn't chain himself to the floor and chain the podium to the floor while he's speaking, gives evidence that his thesis isn't true. He says gravity doesn't exist, and yet with every step he takes, he contradicts his thesis. Okay, that's what I'm talking about. What I'm saying is that when I do evangelism, really with anyone in the world, but I especially have this in mind when I'm doing evangelism with someone who doubts or denies the existence of God, is to remind myself, I am looking at a person here. I'm speaking with a person here who is the image and likeness of God, who lives in a universe created by God, and that, as Psalm 19 and Romans 1 tell us, cries out, really, the existence of God. I'm speaking with someone who is himself a walking, talking advertisement for God's existence. And I'm looking at someone who I know is seeking happiness in everything that he does, and that I know will never find what he's looking for except in God, and except in becoming the person that God has called him to be. Okay, well, here's what I mean by tension now, because this is something that atheists feel as well, that is thoughtful, philosophical atheists. Here's a quotation from John Searle, well-known atheist philosopher of mind, a philosopher of mind. He taught at UC Berkeley for many years and is now retired. But listen to what he says, because this is very powerful, coming from an atheist. There is exactly one overriding question in contemporary philosophy. How do we fit in? How can we square the self-conception of ourselves, that is the conception we have of ourselves as mindful, meaning-creating, free, rational agents? How do we square this conception with a universe that consists entirely of mindless, meaningless, unfree, non-rational, brute, physical particles? Okay, this is the question, addressing it from a number of angles, that I want to ask my atheist friend to ponder. Again, kindly, gently, lovingly. How do you square what you say is true of the universe in which we live with what seems to be the intuitive conception we have of ourselves as human beings? How do you square it? How do we fit in? Which, again, John Searle says, there is exactly one overriding question. He's saying this is it. This is the one overriding question in contemporary philosophy. How do we fit in? And so what I wanted to ask is, how do you square these things? For instance, we are personal beings. We are rational beings. And yet you say that the universe is comprised from top to bottom of impersonal, non-rational, brute physical particles. Nothing but matter and energy, chemistry. We see meaning in things. That's what John Searle referred to as we are meaning creating, are the words he used. But we see meaning in things. We believe that things have meaning. You say that the universe is meaningless. It's just one massive material accident. We are free. You say that the universe is one hopelessly deterministic machine. I mean, a closed system of material cause and effect. So you see what's being asked here. How do we fit in? The conception that we have of ourselves as human persons, the intuitive, natural conception we have of ourselves, completely contradicts the atheist universe. We're personal, the universe is impersonal. We're free, the universe is totally deterministic. It's just a machine of cause and effect. I suppose I can put it like this. When I evangelize someone who doubts or denies the existence of God, my goal, what I'm attempting to do, is to lead this person to see and to feel that the attempt to account for the richness of human experience, the attempt to account for the richness of his human experience in terms of what John Searle refers to as brute physical particles. Well, one of my teachers put it like this. To try to account for the richness of who we are as human beings in terms of matter and energy, random genetic mutation, such. Well, it's like a man made of quicksand trying to climb out of an ocean of quicksand on a ladder made of quicksand. It can't be done. Now, let me give you one concrete illustration that we can begin to talk about. Morality. Okay, we human beings believe intuitively that morality is something real, that right and wrong exist. I mean, C.S. Lewis famously begins his classic Mere Christianity with this basic idea. And I'll read briefly from page one of C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. Everyone has heard people quarreling. Sometimes it sounds funny, sometimes it sounds merely unpleasant, but however it sounds, I believe we can learn something very important from listening to the kinds of things people say. They say things like, "How do you like it if anyone did the same to you? That's my seat. I was there first. Leave him alone. He isn't doing you any harm. Why should you shove in first? Give me a bit of orange. Give me a bit of your orange. I gave you a bit of mine. Come on. You promised." People say things like this every day. I would say all the time. Everyone speaks this way, children through adults, educated people as well as uneducated, children as well as grown-ups. Now, what interests me, again, reading from C.S. Lewis, about all these remarks is that the man who makes them is not merely saying that the other man's behavior does not happen to please him. He is appealing to some kind of a standard of behavior which he expects the other man to know about. And the other man very seldom replies, "To hell with your standard." Nearly always he tries to make out that what he has been doing does not really go against the standard, or that if it does, there is some special excuse. He pretends there is some special reason in particular for why this person who took the seat first should not keep it, or that things were quite different when he was given the bit of orange, or that something has turned up which lets him off the hook of keeping his promise. It looks, in fact, very much as if both parties had in mind some kind of law or rule of fair play, a law of morality, or decent behavior, or morality, or whatever you like to call it, that they have in mind this law about which they really agree. If they had not, they might, of course, fight like animals, but they could not quarrel in the human sense of the word. Quarreling means trying to show that the other person is wrong. And there would be no sense in trying to do that unless you and he had some sort of agreement as to what right and wrong are. Just as there is no sense in saying that a footballer had committed a foul unless there was some agreement about the rules of playing football. Okay, now what Lewis is talking about here, the fact that we all live as though we believed in a law of morality. Okay, this makes sense, obviously, in a world where the ultimate reality is a personal moral God who created us in his image and likeness. He's written his moral law into our very beings. He's etched this into our bones, if you will. This all makes sense. In other words, our experience with morality, the fact that we all act and live as though we believed intuitively that morality was something real, that right and wrong are something real, something that really exists. This makes perfect sense within a Christian theistic worldview. It makes perfect sense. But it does not make sense in a universe that consists entirely of mindless, meaningless, unfree, non-rational, brute physical particles. An atheist universe, within an atheist universe, I'm meaning if atheism were true, if this universe were what the atheist says, it cannot account for the existence of objective moral law. And atheists admit this. Here's an atheist philosopher, Michael Ruse, admitting that in an atheist worldview, objective moral law does not exist. This is what he says. Morality is a biological adaptation, no less than hands and feet and teeth, considered as a rationally justifiable set of claims about an objective something. Ethics is illusory. It's an illusion. I appreciate that when somebody says, "Love thy neighbor as thyself," they think that they are referring to a moral law that exists above and beyond themselves. Nevertheless, such reference is truly without foundation. Morality is just an aid to survival and reproduction. It's an ephemeral product of the evolutionary process. It has no existence or being beyond this, and any deeper meaning is an illusion. It's illusory. This is from a book called The Darwinian Paradigm by atheist philosopher Michael Ruse. Okay, I remember when I was in college, I was sitting in my psychology lecture, in the psychology lecture hall, and my professor came into the room. Now, he was an atheist. And let me give out the number one more time. I'm sorry, I forget to do that. It's 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. If you'd like to be on the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio, give us a call. Okay, he comes into the room, and this psychology professor was an atheist. And he walks into the room. There's probably 100 people in this lecture hall. And I remember so clearly, he just opens his mouth and he says, "Right and wrong do not exist. There is no such thing as a moral law. Morality is relative from person to person. It's relative from culture to culture. There is no objective moral law. I mean, after all, the universe consists of nothing but material substances, particles interacting with one another according to strict physical laws. And everything that exists has just arisen naturally from this material. So nothing exists but material. There is no moral law." And he launched into an illustration. He said there are certain Eskimo tribes. Now, I don't know if this is true, but the illustration's what's important. He said there are certain Eskimo tribes where when grandma and grandpa become too old, they're no longer useful to the society. Well, you just put them on a block of ice and, you know, kick them out into the Bering Straits. And that's the end of grandma and grandpa. And I remember so clearly him saying, "Who are we to say they are wrong? Because after all, there is no moral law existing in this material universe, purely material universe. Morality is relative from person to person and from society to society." I'm listening to this, and I remember, okay, I pulled the Hitler card. I'll admit it up front, all right? I raised my hand, and I said, he called on me, and I said, "Professor," I said, "well, then according to what you're saying here, we could not say that what Hitler did was wrong in any absolute sense. You mean the best that we can say is that we don't like what he did? That morality being relative from person to person and culture to culture, that we don't appreciate what he did? That is that the best we can say?" Okay, no kidding. My professor stood there, you know, staring a little bit like a cow staring at a new gate that he's never seen before. And he kind of began to turn red a little bit, and he began to actually back up, body language, you know, back up into the corner of the lecture hall. And he finally opened his mouth and he said this. He said, "Well, I guess there are some things that we agree on enough that they kind of become wrong." Okay, now I would love it if I could see the looks on the faces of everyone listening to this right now. That's what he said. "I guess there are some things," you know, after he's just said right and wrong don't exist, it's all relative, "there are some things that we agree on enough that they kind of become wrong." Okay, now I have never met a person yet who didn't believe in the existence of a moral law, really. I mean, they may not have thought of it like that, but they believe in right and wrong. I mean, some may say that they believe morality is relative from person to person, but they give evidence all day long, continually in their lives, that they don't really believe that it's relative from person to person. I mean, a lady steps in front of me in line at the grocery store checkout counter, something that Lewis alluded to, that kind of an idea. I say, "Excuse me, but I was already in line." Now, she may respond in a number of ways. She may say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you." Or, "Oh, I'm sorry, but my father is ill. He's sitting in the car. I'm in a big hurry. Please let me go first." She may say, "Well, your shopping cart is full, and I only have a couple of items." The one thing she will never say, the one thing you have never heard anyone say in a situation like this is, you were already in line, so what? Morality is relative from person to person and culture to culture. My moral standards are simply different than yours. Better luck next time, buddy. Now, we can attempt to escape this sort of complete subjectivism of saying, you know, my morality, your morality, each to his own. We can attempt to escape this, as my professor did, by saying that morality is really determined by cultures and societies, and not just by individuals. That right and wrong are societal conventions, as we say, and therefore, while still relative from culture to culture, at least not relative to every human being, but it turns out, really, when you press it, that no one really believes that either. Because if they did, if they really believed that morality is relative from culture to culture, they wouldn't go around talking about how one culture or society is morally superior to another. I mean, why would one argue? I'll give an example. Why would one argue that modern liberal morality is better than ISIS morality? Why would one argue that the moral values of the Peace Corps are better than those of the mafia? If one really believed that right and wrong are cultural conventions and that morality is relative from society to society. The fact is, and C.S. Lewis brings this up in his own words, the moment that you or I say that the morality taught in the Jewish synagogue down the road is superior to the morality taught by Boko Haram in East Africa, the moment we say that, we're appealing to a standard of morality that we see as existing independent of those societies and above them, a measuring stick by which we believe that we can measure them both. And we can say, no, the morality of the Jewish synagogue is superior to the morality of Boko Haram or Hitler and the Nazi Party. We're assuming, when we make these comparisons, the existence of a kind of absolute moral measuring stick, which C.S. Lewis referred to as the law of morality. And here's the thing. If there is no moral measuring stick, if right and wrong don't exist, if there is no moral law, which, of course, we believe that the moral law is God's moral character reflected in creation and written into our hearts, and that's how we know it. But if there is no moral measuring stick, isn't it nonsense for us to argue that one morality is superior to another? I mean, why can't Boko Haram simply say, well, you know, we live by a different set of societal and cultural conventions? Or, as my professor said, who are we to say they are wrong? Ironically, you know, because atheists are the image and likeness of God, they know to their very bones that right and wrong are real. They know it and they live by it. And even though they may say that morality is relative from person to person, they may say it's relative from society to society because they believe that's what they have to say. It's the only position to take that logically follows from atheism, is to basically say that morality is just words we use, you know, right and wrong are words we use to describe what we like and what we don't like. And this differs from person to person and from society to society. Even though they may say this, in order for their lives to not descend into complete and utter moral chaos, they actually live, more or less, as the image and likeness of God that they are. They live as though moral law existed. I think about the ethics professor that is teaching moral relativism, and maybe in his lectures he's mocking the ignorant and the arrogance of those who believe that there are moral absolutes, that right and wrong really exist. But, you know, try cheating on his test on moral relativism. There's one for you. Try cheating on his test on moral relativism and notice how quickly, I mean, presto, how quickly he becomes a moral absolutist. And if you fail your test on moral relativism, try taking a gun into his office and placing it on the desk on your side, looking at him and say, please change my F into an A. After all, morality is relative, and I have different moral values than you. Your atheist moral relativist professor will become a firm believer in right and wrong. Okay, we're going to take a short break at this point. There's the music I love. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. Please give us a call if you'd like to be on the show. Any comment on what I'm teaching or on the Holy Land, whatever you like. 888-914-9149 is the call. Be right back.
Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cutteback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
I really love this kind of music. I'm not sure exactly why. It's not the kind of music I played when I was in bands growing up. It was more like, you know, it was Beatles and beyond. But I enjoy it. It's very uplifting music. This is Ken Hensley filling in for the maestro Patrick Madrid on the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. The number here is 888-914-9149 if you'd like to be on the show. And let me wrap up this one illustration, okay? What I'm talking about, again, is how I think about doing evangelism with those who doubt or deny the existence of God. I believe that the atheist lives in tension, a tension that he, she cannot escape. That is a tension between what he says is true of the world in which we live, that is nothing but matter, evolving by natural processes, no God, no human spirit, no soul, no nothing like that. The tension between what he says is true of the world and who he is as someone made in the image and likeness of God, someone who is seeking a happiness that he will never find except in God, someone whom God is calling to himself, someone whom God has made. And there's this tension, okay? And I'm using as my first illustration the issue of morality. The fact that everybody basically believes that right and wrong are real, they live as though they do, even though they may come through, you know, philosophical training or a process of logic or thought to say that right and wrong are merely cultural conventions or relative from person to person and that they don't really exist. Okay, the professor I mentioned earlier that came into my psychology class, okay, he's a perfect example. Here was a man, he was so confident in his relativism, his moral relativism, that he was willing to walk into a room with 100 students and simply announce as fact that right and wrong do not exist. He was being a consistent atheist. And no doubt he imagined himself to be a moral relativist. I'm sure he wasn't lying. He believed that right and wrong do not exist. And yet when I confronted him with the unpleasant logical implication of his worldview, that is, well, professor, I guess the best we can say is that we don't like what Hitler did. He collapsed. In the end, he just couldn't maintain the fiction that morality is nothing more than cultural convention. The way I would put it is he couldn't escape what he knew as the image and likeness of God. That is, he knows that right and wrong are real. I had a friend named Tony. I used to work waiting tables after seminary. And Tony and I became friends. He was an atheist. He was what I refer to as a scientifically minded atheist. He believed in, you know, the struggle for survival, the survival of the fittest. He had a Darwinian worldview from top to bottom. And so since we were friends, I began kind of playing with him. He'd be standing in line at the bar to order a bottle of wine, and I'd walk up and I would just cut in front of him. And he was shorter than I was. I was larger, I was taller. And I just cut in front of him, you know, and wait for him to complain. And when he complained, "Ken, what are you doing cutting in front of me?" I'd say, "Hey, survival of the fittest, you know. Don't you want the human race to evolve? I'm larger than you are, I'm stronger than you are, and I'm going to get first in line here to get my bottle of wine so that I can make my, you know, customers happy and I can get bigger tips and onward, forward with the human race. And, you know, in discussions along the kind of lines that I'm having here today, just on the issue of morality, if I remember right, he just came to realize that he could not maintain the fiction that right and wrong didn't exist and that it was all relative. Because, in short, within the naturalist or materialist atheist worldview, this worldview cannot account for moral absolutes. It cannot account for the existence of moral law, which means if atheism is true, right and wrong, in the end, are really nothing more than words we use to describe our personal or societal preferences. On the other hand, the existence of objective moral law follows naturally from a Christian theistic worldview. And I think that you can evangelize by pointing this out, which is why C.S. Lewis began his book in the way that he did. Let's go to Mark, though, calling in from Chicago. Mark, love to have you on the show here.
Oh, I can. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just have a quick question for you. What's your take on Sam Harris? I recently watched the debate when he had with Dr. William Lane Craig, and it was a few years ago, I believe, in Christian University, Notre Dame. And obviously, they were both fully involved in that, and I can't remember much about it, but what you just said about morality, Sam was able to reason pretty eloquently, and, you know, to my surprise, he was getting, like, a warm welcome. He was applauded, you know, time and time again by Christian audience. So, you know, I just want to, I mean, there's a lot more to it, but I don't want to take up much time. I just want you to share about what's your take on Sam Harris, please?
Well, thanks for calling, and I'll go ahead and say some things about Sam. Yeah, Sam Harris is one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, that is the four major leaders within the new atheist movement. Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and the late Christopher Hitchens. Now, Sam Harris has written on morality, and here's the interesting thing. I'm glad you brought it up, Mark, because it gives me a chance to elaborate on something. Sam Harris has attempted to come up with a moral system, understanding the problem that I've been describing here, his attempt to come up with a moral system in an atheist universe. And basically what he does is he redefines the concept of morality, and he says right and wrong are right is whatever enhances human flourishing, and wrong is what doesn't enhance human flourishing. And so he basically says, we may not know the answers to every moral question now, but given time, science will be able to tell us, science, what enhances human flourishing. I mean, does abortion, having abortion be safe and legal and all the rest, does that enhance human flourishing, or does it not? And he's saying we will be able to determine what is, quote, right and wrong in that way. Now, the problem, and I think I've heard that debate, too, that William Lane Craig brought out. The problem here, though, is he is, I'm not going to say sneakily or surreptitiously, but what he has done is he has redefined moral categories in scientific terms, and he's eliminated morality in this sense. You know, Sam Harris also believes in a total determinism. So he doesn't believe in free will at all. He believes that we live within a gigantic mechanical universe, and everything that takes place within that universe takes place within the context of strict cause and effect, and that that's true of our lives as well. So he doesn't believe in freedom. He would say, Mark, that everything you do or whatever you do is what you have to do at that moment, given the prior state of the universe, your experiences in life and whatnot. And so when he talks about moral issues, for instance, he talks about famously about Ted Bundy, the man who tortured and murdered something like 35 young women some years back. I think it was in the 70s when it was happening. And what he says about Ted Bundy is, he says Ted Bundy was only doing what he had to do as a material creature living within an entirely material universe, and all the forces applied to him. Ted Bundy was only doing what he had to do. He's like a rattlesnake. He's exactly like a rattlesnake who just jumps up when you step on him and bites you. He could do nothing other than kill those women. And so he basically says, that is, Sam Harris basically says, There's no need to bring out moral terms like right or wrong. There's no reason to say that Ted Bundy was evil or that he did anything evil. Just like a rattlesnake that bites you, you know, you're just going to kill it or move away from it or put it into a prison cell where it can't bite anyone else. He says that we should take Ted Bundy and just put him in a prison cell so he can't do it to anybody else. But there's no reason to use moral terms. So what I would say, Mark, is this, that what he's attempted to do is to redefine morality in scientific categories such that morality doesn't exist. And he's willing to say that. He's willing to say that the words like right and wrong, good and evil, don't mean anything. And they're words that we should drop. We should think just in practical terms. Ted Bundy was not doing evil. Ted Bundy was not an evil man. Ted Bundy was, well, put it like this. Ted Bundy was not very good at enhancing human flourishing. Mark, you still there?
Beautiful, yes. Thank you for shedding light on it. And yeah, this is, I'm just a little worried that people like Sam Harris are finding a fertile ground, especially among young people, because he, again, by the reaction of these young kids from the university, they were applauding him. They were like literally, you know, giving him red carpet treatment.
Oh, Mark, if you want to hang on, I'll be with you on the other side of the break. We've got a hard break now. This is Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149.